podcast.
Hello and welcome to Q&A Quest episode 441. I'm your host, Mike East Lover Apps Stuff. With me as always,
player of many versions of East 1, 2, and all those later and earlier, David McBurney, Fanboy Master.
And this is Joe, a.k.a. Smokin' Joe Gamer, the guy who streams on Tuesday and Thursday night.
You just streamed an East game, didn't you?
I finished East 10 Proud Nordics. They're not just Nordics. They became very proud.
Nice.
And
in my experience, I usually come before a fall.
Yes. Well, it's a swashbuckling adventure that combines Vikings, pirates, and some Norse mythology, and it's great. I like the ship battles.
Is there some version of Loki in that game I should be prepared for?
No.
Okay.
Well, maybe, because it's legally distinct Norse mythology, so it's not Valhalla, it's Walhalla.
Legally distinct from something that no one owns.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough. But it's just the names are different, but there's a guy that maybe is Loki. I don't know. Yeah.
That's just how East does it. Have you ever looked how the Roman Empire is spelled in East?
Roman.
R O M U N.
Yeah. East is really just legally distinct Europe.
Yeah.
If you know anything about the initial legend of Vildis, that makes sense.
Where is East supposed to be?
Vildis, as you would guess, just from like that name, is like a Breton, like French Breton legend. It was a mythical city off the coast, on the coast of Brittany. In the north, what would be in the northwest of modern France, that was swallowed by the ocean,
or in this case,
the version
went way the above the ocean.
the version in ancient East vanished, and East 2, the final chapter, does not terribly resemble the legend of Vildis, but it did ground the series in being very European.
I'm trying to think where,
except for the Korean version of East 2.
Interesting.
The East 2 special is allegedly quite different. Adds dwarves and elves to the story, and also has you get the final super equipment from the semi-mythical founder of Korea. I'd love to play that version someday, but I can't read Korean. Also, it was a buggy DOS game that was kind of hard to play when it was new in terms of getting it to run.
Well, let's take a moment and figure out where every East is in relation to Europe. So, three. Where the hell is three?
Well, you wandered from East. It's like East 3 could kind of be anywhere.
It's true.
Oh, over there.
Over 4 there. Is... I don't even know.
Is that like Germany? A giant forest?
Yeah, I was looking at a world map here before. Let's see here. This one has it like almost in Spain. Salceda. Where is East 3 in this one? Looks like Germany or. Oh my god, dang. I'm gonna have to look at a European map.
You're learning so much.
Germany. places it in Germany. East 9 is France.
I say East 9, probably France, because it would be like the Bastille. Yeah. And I think 10 would be Norway, maybe.
The actual legend, for the record, the actual legend of East 6 that's based on Utnapishtim is a legend that originates in southern Iraq.
Ooh.
This is nothing. We are just burning time.
Yeah, hold on. Yeah, I'm assuming East 10, Norway. East 8 looks like the islands off of Greece. East 5, Egypt. East 7 is I need to look at a map of Northern Europe. Not Northern Europe, Northern Africa. Algeria. Algeria or Tunisia?
Yeah, those are, I believe, quite close to each other.
East 5 is Egypt. One I still, even though there's an English patch, I need to play that at some point.
It's an interesting one. East 8... steadies itself around the like the great tree of origin is allegedly supposed to be the Mahabodhi tree.
East 6 is like the Bermuda Triangle.
Yeah, except that the legend of the Ark of Utnapishtim would also put it in. It would also originate from Iraq. A lot of these are not super close.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
There are many with a great flood.
Well, it's a fun series regardless. You don't really need to know. Match it up to real-world places.
Yeah, it is not meant to be one-to-one to any real-world place, but they do like using real-world like mythologies and places, so it can be interesting to see where they're going.
Yep.
And of course, the canonical end of that all is that he tries to go to the North Pole and it's never seen again. He does that when he's in his 60s. The oldest we have ever seen him is 24.
Wow.
Well, so they could do like 30 more games.
They could do way more than 30 if they keep going. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Seriously.
I mean, hell, they fit in a brand new game in between 2 and 4.
Yeah.
I would point out that I think 1 through 10 would take place somewhere. Like, I think Adol is 16 in each one, maybe 18.
I think 16, because I think they said he's 17 in 10.
Yeah, 16 sounds right. So, yeah, like, over the course of 8 years, he's been to, like, basically all of the Europe you would expect him to by that point.
Okay.
He's already infamous by 9.
Okay, so do we want to... Okay, so you've been playing East.
Yeah.
Got it. Joe, what have you been playing?
Well, we've all been playing... Leon Must Die Forever, and that's a fun mode, isn't it?
That's a roguelike mode. It counts. Yeah.
Right, and
you level up.
Right, when you kill the zombies, you get XP in the form of like blood, and then you upgrade your abilities, or you get new abilities. Yeah.
Yeah, well, there's like additional runs you can go on when you successfully complete it. It's interesting. Yeah.
So I made it to the end twice and could not beat Victor, but I think I'm getting the hang of it. I think with the right weapons and build, I could take him out. although I learned the hard way, like, don't get rid of your hatchet.
Don't fight over that hot dog. Wait, no, that you're not going to get that joke. Don't worry about it.
Okay. Well, no, because there's a perk that says if you discard an item, you get 10% health back. and my hatchet broke. It wouldn't let me sharpen it. I thought, okay, gee, let me take that perk and throw away this useless axe, and then found out, no, you can get it resharpened if you find a green axe power-up in the environment.
Important.
So I was playing that. Yeah, we already established that I beat East 10 Proud Nordics. Jump back into Xenoblade Chronicles X. That's my new streaming game for RP Gamer, and it's the Definitive Edition, Switch 2 Edition, etc. So I was playing that on Thursday, and I've been talking about Final Fantasy 14 a lot, and yeah, I was playing that a little bit last night and a little bit like a few days ago, but haven't been playing enough to really justify the subscription, and I just like ordered some more stuff online, and it's like, yeah, let's maybe take another break from this for a little bit. Although the Shadowbringers content so far is quite good, and I'm hoping to get all caught up before Evercold comes out, but it's doubtful, but whatever, you know, maybe I'll just be playing this game for the rest of my life. Who knows? So there's that. What else? Oh, I've been having a ball with some PS3 games, some Ratchet & Clank, Future Tools of Destruction. I beat Little Big Planet 1, jumped into 2, and I just got the Vita game in the mail, so I'm going to play that at some point. Yeah, so I'd like to play through all the little... I want to play through all the Little Big Planet games, okay? I just do.
I'm fighting so hard not to say more like Little Shit Planet.
Well, obviously the servers are shut down, so you can't make or share levels anymore. So I'm just doing the story content, which is bizarre and also very British, and I think it's neat.
I think Stephen Fry is all over it.
Yeah. Oh, he's awesome. So let's see, there was that. Yeah, playing some Ratchet & Clank games. DuckTales Remastered, remember that? Yeah, I'm playing that. Yeah. And it's neat. It succeeds as a game on its own merits. It's quite good. But as like a remaster or more like a remake, it's like, okay, yeah, they altered the level design and made the levels bigger and longer, and now there's additional objectives, and there's just a whole lot of cutscenes, and it's got all the voice actors from the cartoon series, you know, and everything looks like the cartoon series. So again, great game, but there is part of me that's like, you know, I just loved the NES game as a kid, and maybe I just wanted that with better graphics. I don't know. But I am playing it, and I am finally going to beat it, I hope. It's not very long. And yeah, but that's the thing. I got, you know, since I got my PS3 back, I just downloaded a whole bunch of digital games that I forgot I even had, and a lot of them were through the Plus service. So I have like 100 games installed on there right now. I had a 720 gigabyte hard drive installed. So got a whole lot of PS3 games to play, and I did end up getting the Sly Cooper collection and the Jack and Daxter collection. So playing those, they were very cheap digital, very expensive physical, but I bought them digitally, and then it lets you download the game separately, which is fine. So if I can go into that real quick, I'll try not to take up too much time, but basically, so the Sly Cooper collection, you can get it digitally on PS3 for $15. Those versions are actual remasters that updated the, you know, like the widescreen resolution, and you get updated textures and other stuff. It's pretty neat. Physical copy I seen going for around 40, 50 bucks for PS3. Now, what they did was on PlayStation Plus Premium, you have PS5 and PS4 versions that are just emulation from PS2. So it's 4x3. You know, you get rewind, you get save states, but it still is just pretty basic PS2 emulation. So I'm like, all right, yeah, I'd rather get the actual PS3 remasters. They look better, and now I actually own the games. It's like I'm not paying 18 bucks a month to play those games, you know. And you can buy them for 10 bucks each on PS5, but I'm like, again, for 15 bucks, I got all three on PS3 actual remasters that look better, and I like it. In the case of Jack and Daxter, it's like, well, there's very subtle differences visually between the two games. Like, you can see how they've updated textures and stuff in the PS3 version, but I wouldn't say either one is better. They just look a little different. But that game's weird because, so it, digitally it's $10. Physically, I think you can get it as low as 30, 35. But those games had already gotten ported to PS4, and it's just PS2 emulation. And currently, the first one is 40, 2 and 3 are both 15. Like, okay. Just the first one got updated for PS5, so with some additional, like, resolution upscaling, a little bit of extra texture filtering, $10, you get, you know, you get your rewind and your save states. But again, I'm like, for $10, I'll buy the PS3 versions, you know. And it's fine. So yeah, I got 6 games to play basically. And one other thing, the Ratchet and Clank collection, very, very expensive physically. Digitally, I think it's still $20 or $25, and that's just the first 3 PS2 games. And you to play them on PS5, you need Plus Premium, and you have to stream them. So those never got ported or remastered or anything. Well, not since the PS3 versions anyway. So I'm like, it's weird just how all 3 franchises got treated quite differently. That's all I wanted to end with. Yeah, I don't know. Sony makes weird decisions regarding some of its franchises.
Seems like they gave a shit about their games and the others didn't.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think this... So, and I didn't realize Sly Cooper was Sucker Punch.
Yep.
I didn't know
they
that.
They did Rocket Robot on Wheels. They did Rocket Robot on Wheels on the N64 and then jumped straight to Sly Cooper on PS2 for Sly 1 through 3, then Infamous 1 and 2 on PS3, plus the Festival of Blood expansion.
Yep.
Well, Sanzaru did Sly 4, which would have been a perfectly, which would have been a great follow-up if it weren't for the fact that they were not allowed to finish it.
Oh, what happened?
The original proposal had them releasing like a final episode of DLC later, because the end of that game is like, and then Sly Cooper got lost in time.
Oh. Well, I didn't play it yet, but okay.
Yeah, I figured you should just be prepared for that before it happens.
Yeah, well, because I knew he was a thief in time, and it's like, yeah, you know, time travel can get a little wonky, so no, that... I suspected that could be how it ends. But that's it. I started playing 4, and then I'm like, you know, I kind of want to go back and play 1 through 3. And I was playing 4 on the Vita, and it was like, oh, this is neat. You know, I got this through the Plus service. It was, I guess it was a cross-buy title. So, oh, cool, I can play this on my Vita. And then it was like, yeah, but wouldn't you rather play on PS3? It's like, yeah. The PS3 version is 60 FPS. The Vita does a good job with it at 30 FPS. Not going to complain too much. But yeah, I would rather play it on PS3. But now I'm going to play 1 through 3 and then play 4. Yep.
Yeah, I'm pretty used to playing Sly Cooper at 30 because on PS2 it ran at an inconsistent 30. What a time to be alive.
Jeez. Oh yeah.
That's a pretty good game.
So that's it. All just playing PS3 games and jump back into Resident Evil just, you know, to do that. Oh, I did play through Resident Evil 7 again, this time the PS5 version, and I did do a no healing playthrough on Easy. And of course, Easy gives you enough ammo to kill everything twice. But I still died once or twice because I tell you, every time I play that game, it takes me at least 2 tries to beat Marguerite. I don't know what it is. Maybe I underestimate her. Maybe I play too well up to that point and the adaptive difficulty kicks my ass. I don't know.
I think 7 does too much adaptive difficulty.
No? Okay.
Well, that's more of an RE2 remake onward thing.
So even on Easy, she still killed me once and I was very surprised. I'm like, all right, you know, and then I got her the second time. But then the other fights were fine. Then, of course, if you give the antidote to Mia, then you don't have to fight her. If you give it to Zoe, then Mia gets pissed off and tries to murder you.
Also, both of them die anyway, so there's really just not a lot of point to giving it to Zoe.
No.
Spoilers.
Well, Mia and Ethan are both mold people at this point, right? I don't know.
Spoilers. I'm joking. I beat the game on stream. Pretty sure you guys were watching.
Didn't Jack kill both of them? And then, Mia would have died sooner than that to get taken over by the mold. Okay.
We'll worry about it later. I'll be real quick since I haven't been playing a lot of RPGs. I did a quick run through of RE3. That game's bad. PS1 version, I should clarify. And have I played anything else worthy of mention? Nope.
No Pragmata? Oh, I beat Pragmata, by the way.
Yeah, I need to get back to it. I've just been fucking exhausted. I'm in the middle of like planning a move and shit, so.
Oh.
It's time consuming and expensive.
Yeah, moving sucks.
I'm not even moving that far, but it's time consuming and expensive.
You're just moving somewhere else in the city?
Yeah, just moving somewhere else in Seattle.
Nice.
I need to visit
Seattle at some point.
You damn well do.
Yes.
I missed you, man.
We gotta go see a Kraken game.
I'll go with you and see one if you come into Seattle.
Yeah.
I didn't know that Nintendo owned the Mariners at one point, or part of the Mariners.
Yeah. No, all of them for decades.
And
that's why all of their baseball games were headlined by Ken Griffey Jr.
Yeah, I was going to say, I loved that game on N64, the Ken Griffey Jr. baseball. And there was a funny code you could put in that would let you, like, walk around and fly and stuff. It was great. Yeah.
Major League Baseball featuring Ken Griffey Jr.
Yeah, I was going to say I moved out of my parents' house when I went to college the first time, but I still came home on weekends to do laundry and stuff. So most of my stuff was still at my parents' house, and I still had a bedroom and a bed and all that. And I had my own place for like four or five years. And then I moved back into their house for 6 years, and then I moved in here 10 years ago. And it's just back and forth across town, basically. But even still, right, like you said, it's every time you move, it's like you got to go through all your stuff. It's like, okay, what am I taking with me? What do I want to sell? What do I want to throw away?
To the goddamn Shadow Realm.
And even now, my parents will still call me up periodically and be like, oh, by the way, we still found this thing of yours in the basement. And it's like, oh, I forgot about that. Sorry. But they couldn't find my old Sega Genesis games. Of course not. Damn it.
And such is life.
I did find them and sell them already, and I just don't remember. But no, they swear up and down that they did not find any Sega Genesis cartridges.
Yeah. They must have disappeared at some point.
Yep.
We will leave the subject on the note that Ken Griffey Jr., Major League Baseball featuring Ken Griffey Jr. on the N64... was developed by the company that would one day become the developers of Red Dead Redemption.
Oh.
Wow.
Yep. Angel Studios. Okay.
Questions.
Yeah, we should probably get on those. As opposed to...
We could talk more about baseball. We could talk about people charging the mound.
I mean, I love the history of charging the mound. It's not what anyone who bothers coming here is here for.
It's true. I'm just going to tell you that the episodes you have coming up are amazing.
I'm excited. Okay, so we're hitting some, because Fireminer has been patiently putting questions in here.
Oh, boy. God.
I already am terrified of this. The way this one starts. Wake up, baby. No. New indie discourse just dropped, this time around a mixtape and nostalgia bait game made by people who didn't live through the period. I mean, romanticizing the past is one of the most common human experiences in history, so I'm not going to like get too mad at these kids.
How many 80s-themed things do we have from people who were probably babies in the 80s at best?
Yeah. I don't know if mixtape is 80s or 90s. Like, all I've seen is people getting mad about it.
I thought it was 90s. I saw people getting mad at it and just noped out of any such discourse.
Adventure game. Inspired tonally and visually by 80s coming-of-age films, such as the work of John Hughes. At this point, I don't care. It's not for me. But like the level of hyperbolic fury I've seen at it is just like, man, you guys gotta have. There are so many better things to be like, so many better emotions to have, and even if you're gonna be angry, so many better things to be angry about.
Are they angry that it's not accurate or it's just nostalgia?
Yeah. No. Just take all the things that you're thinking and just assume the answer is yes.
I don't fucking care. Is it good? That's all I care. Is it a good game?
I've not been able to find out because people are too busy being mad at it conceptually.
I don't fucking care if it's accurate or not. Is it fun? Yes? No?
Well, there's people on Blue Sky who say it's amazing game of the year, best game they ever played, but I take those with a grain of salt as well, to be honest with you.
Yeah, like, I'll get around to it eventually, maybe, if, like, people still care in a few months. It's like, not my immediate thing. It's whatever, man. Just, like, being this mad at something for conceptual concept, at, like, reasons rather than, like, execution ones is just weird to me.
Yeah, I know. Okay. I'm over here playing in fake Europe, and people are complaining about this shit.
Any and all fantasy, like, the as we conceive of it, is often, like, lightly pastiche nostalgia for things that we never experience. Let's see. So there is a Seventh Heaven pop-up bar recently opened in Tokyo, except that it's named Lemon Heaven because Sephiroth appeared in an Asahi beer ad for their canned lemon shaved ice flavored drink, which they serve at the bar. You know what? I'd visit just to say I'd been there. It's one time where I heard people arguing about whether furry costumes look too uncanny on default just because they were in 3D, had textures. Can't imagine the discussion gets resurrected by the Star Fox remake. I've seen... My favorite thing has been, and I'll keep this brief, but I have seen people having arguments about whether the new models in the new Star Fox are sufficiently hot. Half the time it has been people. There's layers to this because half the time I've seen people arguing that these models are bad because not even furries would want to have sex with these. Followed by seeing furries respond with "au contraire." Like, do not concern troll whether furries find these fuckable.
Gaijin picked the perfect time to jump in. Wow.
Wow.
I think that was the ideal place to drop in.
Welcome to discourse.
Yay.
Nothing but.
I've got about 1 hour of free time in here. So what are we talking about?
We are talking about the Star Fox 64 remake for Switch 2.
Okay, and good. Something I don't actually care about. Cool. Right.
Yeah. So we've got a bit more to this one. The Star Fox remake will let you create character avatars that mimic your own face to be used for voice chat and multiplayer. How often do Nintendo enforce etiquette and hate speech rules in their IP? I learned new slurs on Miiverse, you know. I'm sure that they, like, if a video went viral of someone shouting racial slurs while using the Fox chat thing, they would, like, use all of their legal power to take it down. But in person-to-person chat, like, it's going to be down to do you report them.
Just note, they have good lawyers, people.
Currently possible via Tomodachi Life. This is going to be interesting.
What was that about Tomodachi Life?
Apparently, Tomodachi Life has very few, if any, filters.
Oh, yeah. The way they got around it was that they basically made it so that it's very hard to share clips. Uh-huh. So, like, that was their way of trying to avoid, like, harassment and hate speech shit. It's like, you can do whatever you want, it's just going to be really hard for you to show other people you're doing it. The mixtape tape is kind of an autoplay semi FMV game. It has tons of licensed music, but normal games you'd have had to make dynamic tracks. You're just too expensive for licensed music, so mixtape just kind of plays itself. It has the touch and dare. Even modern Transformers and mid-series can't afford their licenses, from what I heard. Mixtape is funded by the money of the daughter of Larry Ellison. Oof. Okay,
oh, well, no.
Maybe I won't spend money on that.
I got rid of HBO because of that fucking guy.
Yeah. The less you know about Larry Ellison, the better, but I know that he's a piece of shit. Okay, so we've got three that must be read in the line before we start our discussion.
He doesn't even own HBO yet, Joe.
Yes.
He's working on it. Give it a year. Okay. Developers used to have the mindset, because consumers got PCs got better so quickly, they could afford to make things that demanded a lot of horsepower, because consumers could wait for a year to get a new machine good enough. There's been an observable fact for over a decade that people have stopped upgrading PCs yearly and are now increasingly sticking with machines that are 6 or 7 years old. In that light, your defense of Unreal 5's Lumen and Nanite in the last episode didn't hold strong. Let's assume that no one could have predicted the GPU and RAM drought caused by AI. No one could have predicted the global economic slump on the break or the breakdown of the global supply chain, but it must have been surely dawned on Epic that many gamers are running on hardware from the mid-2010s, like the GTX 1060, right? Just doesn't feel like a mistake here for an over-optimistic assumption of the hardware market. It's a worse blunder than Crytek thinking that processor speed could only get linearly faster, and so configuring CryEngine 2 for single-core processors, hence why Crysis ran so badly. The thing is that... So let's look at when UE5 was first in. Like, let me get a... let me pull up some history on that, and I'll... Like, it will... explain at least a little bit about why this choice might have made sense at the time. And I'm going to continue cutting them some slack on that. So, UE5 was revealed in May of 2020. I would suspect that it had been in development for at least 4 years at that point. The choices had been made 10 years ago. And yeah, like the major tail off starts in and around that period. So yeah, they made a bad bet. And like, I think that there were signs they could have read that would have prevented them from making that bad bet. But I also don't think it was that, like, it's garden variety bad decisions rather than like someone walking around with blinders.
And honestly, anything involving 2020 means that everyone got caught blind to begin with.
Let's see. But yeah, I think. Sector. Yeah, and you like the other thing is that like Unreal puts people in a weird position because there just aren't a lot of other options at this point. Rolling your own engine at this stage is just heinously expensive and time consuming. Very few companies can afford it. And what other like engines for like full scale AAA development do you have at this point? So like this feels a lot worse because like when the marquee features fail on this, the entire industry is just sort of stuck in the rut with it. But I do get how they ended up producing, like, making these decisions and how that ended up being the case. Because, yeah, like, these decisions were likely being made, like, not 5 years ago when the engine released, but 10 years ago when the engine was being, like, the next generation of Unreal was being conceived. I won't cut them some slack if they decide that there needs to be, that... UE6 needs to come out and that it needs to do even more instead of trying to do more with less. But apparently people from Epic have mentioned the idea of an Unreal Engine 6 showing up in like 2028. So I guess we'll see. But yeah, I'll give them some slack. So many companies have had to change their strategy, not just because consumers are more knowledgeable and price sensitive, also because everyone just has less money. One of my company's customers is a cereal company, and you'll pull your hair out when you hear their representatives talk about how cereals have become a status symbol. But it's true that so many families have stopped eating cereals because they are too expensive for what they get you. I don't know how many AAA game studios have gotten it in their heads that a big part of their customer base can only pay less from now on. The only markets left for expansion are those with low purchasing powers in the first place. Like, that's going to come down to, like, developers need to make games that can be profitable at lower prices, and that's going to be a whole other problem. The big problem, I think, at this point is that companies have, like, tied themselves to the most overtly reactive consumers, and they're not representative consumers. The people who, like, you know, are screaming at you because they saw that you reused an animation are not a representative consumer base and not a useful one to respond to. But they are the one that makes the most noise, so they are the one that is easiest to respond to. And it continues with the way that people have... that AAA has always used the sheer its own sheer cost as a differentiating factor. But ultimately, some elements of consumer pressure are going to have to give. Like, you're going to have to make games that are smaller or less expensive. Like, not smaller and less expensive, but smaller, less visually impressive, more overtly unpolished. Some combination of those. Or, you know, the entire enterprise just has to fall down and crater. Like, we're obviously in the middle of a major crash. We just don't know when we'll hit bottom because, you know, there's all the other economic factors currently existing. But it's, you know, even... I don't think that a human exists that could fail to notice that that's happening. But... I do think that
for whom it makes more sense to ignore it because they're still so they can still make money off of it.
Yeah, but even like to ignore something is to make a choice. Yeah. But yeah, like unless your reasoning is motivated by something other than the observable facts, like the choice has to be. But yeah, like companies and the way that they're set up, the notion of releasing smaller, cheaper games, just most of them does not exist despite the continued success of things like indie development that have, you know, showcased that there are in fact paths forward that don't involve putting 300 people on a full-scale development cycle for 5 years. Let's see. People often bemoan Koei and Sega's DLC strategy, but recently the game Graveyard Keeper was offered for free for 4 days, and it didn't just create a lot of buzz for the upcoming sequel. Developer also made $250,000 from selling DLC. So much of the act of profiting through DLC or gacha in that matter comes down to softening and obscuring the psychological impact of seeing the sticker price. Yes? What I would say is the difference here and why I would consider DLC separate from gacha, even if I'm not always a fan of DLC strategies, is that DLC inherently allows some degree of, like, price discrimination. Like, you pull up your DLC because... Like, you buy the DLC because you want the thing. If someone doesn't want the thing badly enough for that price, they still can purchase game. Whereas, you know, gacha is designed to, you know, to essentially engender an idea of like, well, I could get that in a dollar and essentially put you in a situation where it could be anywhere from a dollar to infinity dollars. Which is why in general, like, if a game has a lot of DLC, I'm not going to love it. But I'm also at least going to be able to, like, accept that, like, well, if I don't want it, I don't buy it. But yes, like, there is value in, like, because this also hits another, like, psychological issue that the loudest part of the consumer base has, which is the way that people will be like, well, I need, like, if it doesn't have everything, if it's not the very best version, then I'm getting ripped off. And it's like, it's fine if it's just a good version. Like, you don't need all of that. You don't need everything all the time. Like, good can be good enough.
It's okay that you have East 10 and not East 10 Proud Nordics. You're good.
Like,
it's fine.
East 10 is still a fine game. Let's see.
I was just going to say, I see that argument all the time about, like, Atlas games, and it's just like, you had a very good game. You probably played through that very good game. You probably had a blast. What are you complaining about?
Because other people have it better.
It's one of those things, like, people are very, like, I don't even know how to describe it, like, there's certain, like, people describe things as being like loss averse, but that's not quite right. Like, fear of missing out tends to be a motivator that can look like loss aversion, but I think is probably more closer to what is motivating a lot of, like, hardcore consumers. Like, I need to have the best, the most, the biggest. But yeah, speaking of Koei, I previously brought up the idea that fans thought Tekken put too little effort into the Atelier collaboration versus what Atelier did. How about we extend it to actual stuff? What is the laziest collaboration you've seen in real life? Imagine my surprise when hearing people complain that 20 years ago, Kellogg's could make Pokemon-shaped sprinkles to put on Pop-Tarts, but nowadays they just slap the Pokemon logo onto the box art. And sell it exclusively at Target. Like, the Happy Meal toys have gotten worse, which means the only thing people scalpers look forward to now are the Pokemon card game collaborations. Like, that one, I'm now far enough outside the Target demo that, like, I don't even know where to begin with it. Like,
the Happy Meal things are occasionally good. Look, if you're happen to be watching on stream, observe Ninja Turtle, Hello Kitty. But yes,
okay,
they are mostly shit.
Yeah,
mostly.
Like, I think you know, the inevitable, like, way that corporations use cross branding is to draw eyes to the product, and once you bought the product, they don't really care what was inside it. And children are very susceptible to seeing Pikachu and wanting to have that Pikachu. So
are adults.
I get it. Well, yes, obviously. But the difference is that the adults don't have an excuse.
It's true.
But yeah, just one of those things that, like, yeah, it's... I'm outside the Target demo, so I have not actually kept up with how bad some of these products are. I'm trying to think of what, like... On the one hand, we had more accurate Pokemon products when I was a child, but on the other hand, I don't think any of the current crop have killed anyone, so... swings and roundabouts. That does remind me of this, of an old, incredibly ghoulish Onion article. Let me see if I can find this. Fun toy banned because of three stupid dead kids. Which is one of the grimmest things I've ever seen.
Jesus.
That sounds like I remember Saturday Night Live used to have, or had a couple bits with Candace Bergen and Dan Aykroyd, where Candace Bergen was giving an interview over unsafe toys and Dan Aykroyd was the toy company representative, and it was things like bags of glass. Very similar vibes there. It's like, he's trying to explain why these are all great toys for kids, and she's just like, but they'll hurt themselves. It's like, oh, it's a learning experience.
Let us all contemplate the many years that lawn darts with sharp tips were, like, normal things to find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I almost got hit by one of those.
Yep. Those were banned real early because of the obvious problem with them, which is to say, those were banned in 1970.
Oh, jeez.
Yeah. Oh, then why the hell did my grandfather still have them in the 90s, unless they were a different design?
Or he just bought them back in the 70s and never got rid of them.
For a while, you could get away with just marking that they were dangerous. And then, like, in the 80s, it seems like they eventually finally, like, said, like, no, these, you can't have these be sharp. I'm sorry, it's over.
I want to say they must have, I think they put these little metal pieces over the tip to soften the blow if you were to get hit.
I think they just stopped making the damn things out of metal.
Too. But I almost got hit in the head though, and it wasn't like a pointed end, is what I'm saying. I don't know. That's
yeah. Odd. Yeah.
It would have hurt me, but it wouldn't have stuck into my brain and killed me. You know.
Yeah. You wait the end of it, which will probably concuss a child, but at least will not stab them in the head.
Yeah.
Let's see. Last month I asked about Andy Weir and the insistence of some artists and audience in refusing to engage or even accept the existence of anything political in art. What other examples are there? Like, I've heard people complain that punk was ruined because it became too political, which is a laughable statement.
Yes. I mean, the punks will just laugh at you for that one.
Yeah, at that point you just have to ask if some people are just that dumb, or is it because the industry made it to be like that through commercialization? In order to sell it to as many people as possible, they will always, always, always dumb down the any behind-the-scenes message to make it as inoffensive as possible, regardless of how repugnant your beliefs are. The issue we have seen over the past few years is that has been that every message has been sanded down to such a degree that people whose fundamental beliefs include things like being kind to others is weakness and must be destroyed, have now found that is a bridge too far. So, you know, your fucking children's show can't tell you that children should share things. But yeah. But fundamentally, like, there's also just like a unwillingness to engage with the nature of what art is beyond the aesthetic of what we've seen art look like in the past. The notion of communicating any, like, the old jokes about, like, the notion of communicating anything more complicated than isn't it cool when the robot fired a gun. It's we've been to this before. We know where this goes.
Can I interrupt with something funny real quick? Last night during Shenanigans I was playing Final Fantasy 14 on my PS5, I was struggling with a quest because it wanted me to use the save feature in the chat, which means that your character says it out loud and then only people in the vicinity will see it. And I'm telling you, I couldn't get it to work because they wanted me, as part of a quest, they wanted me to say, to summon this fairy. And I could have sworn it said F-E-O-U-I. And I kept typing it. It's not working. I'm like, all right, let me go switch to the computer and where I have a keyboard. Still couldn't get it to work. It turns out it's UL. But I, you know what I mean? But the L and the I can look similar based on the font. I'm like, how stupid is that? Like, and there's all these people online. They're like, well, how, you know, how could somebody think that it was UI? Durr. And it's like, because it. So anyways, once you put in the correct command, it works just fine. But then you have to type in two more statements, and if there's any spelling errors, any punctuation errors, any capitalization errors, it simply doesn't work, and there's no error message to tell you why. It's wild.
Sounds like a bad game.
And after doing all that, my orange fairy friend showed up and scolded the other fairies for being mean to me, and now I can finally get on with whatever quest I was supposed to be doing, because I've completely forgotten why I'm here.
Yeah. Nor am I certain why I am here.
I like
so I thought
stories.
You guys might get a kick out of that. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry. Continue.
Okay, that's it. A few more of these. Let's see. There's a story that has been troubling me. Do you know that Shonen Jump receives on average a new draft per day? And the acceptance rate is about 1 in 48. Then you remember anecdotes like Dragon Ball GT was made because the industry crashed after Dragon Ball Z ended. And that show employed like half the workforce. Japan's cultural export is now a bigger chunk of their GDP than their industrial export, but so much of it just seems so fragile and reliant on just a few pillars. That's kind of, like, I think some of that is slightly, like, exaggerated, but yeah, I mean, they're, like, cultural trends are ephemeral, Like, you can't... Like, one of the things that happens when you're an industrial export is that you can continue to build on existing technology. You can't really do that with culture. Like, you know, if Dragon Ball is doing well, like, as much as there is kind of an internal attempt from manga publishing to build build a bigger, better Dragon Ball, like, you know, I'm sure, oh god, one of the things that's going to be terrifying is to see what does Jump do when One Piece finally dies. And I think part of the reason that One Piece is finally, like, reaching the point where it can end, at least in part, is that it no longer, like, triples the sales of everything else on the in the magazine. But yeah, like, as much as, like, the way that like, manga magazines, especially, like, Jump properties, select for new manga tends to be what resembles a current success, like, culture cannot work the same way and is always inherently at the mercy of a much more difficult to gauge in like health in terms of its of capacity to export. We've all seen, like, you know, everyone sees this. Nothing is popular forever. Everything goes in and out of style. It's just always a question of how long it takes. But when your prime export is style, that can be very economically terrifying. So I get what you're getting at. That's why the Demon Slayer anime got dragged out for so long and the last arc got turned into a multiple theatrical movies. People are dreading what will happen when after the show finally ends. But yeah, like, yeah, you know, and it's, you know, you'll see that, like, I'm kind of curious what the Demon Slayer, like, author, I have no idea what they do now, but let's see. Like, you'll get some authors who continue to put out successful manga after successful manga, and then you'll get some that, like, have one big success and then they try to follow it up and it does nothing. Like, if you ever looked at Masashi Kishimoto's manga after Naruto, it was just a kind of an instant bomb. It lasted, yeah, like, a year. Yeah.
Yeah, but again, it's still bringing in his old stuff is still bringing in royalties like there's no tomorrow. So he's,
yeah, I'm sure he's set, but it is. But more, I'm bringing up the fact that, like, there's no guarantee that one success will translate into lasting success. But then you'll look at someone like Hiromu Arakawa of Full Metal Alchemist, and she's done, like, four or five fairly successful manga.
Also, it depends on how you define success here. Like, I know a couple mangaka who, I mean, for them, they've had, like, multiple popular series of up to 25 to 30 volumes each.
Yeah, some are just able to keep doing that.
Yeah, anything at the Naruto, Bleach, or One Piece level is so intensive on the creator's part that they have trouble switching out afterwards almost by default, just because it's been such a huge part of their life for the last quarter century in the case of Oda.
I don't think that Oda will ever make another manga of any significant length.
I kind of hope not, honestly.
I'm not sure if he wants to.
Yeah, I don't suspect he does. I'm just saying, like, yeah. I would suspect that he is going to be like, I don't want to undersell Toriyama, who jumped from Dr. Slump, which was quite popular for in its day, to Dragon Ball, and then basically just decided that he was kind of done doing anything that lasted more than, like, 15 chapters.
I mean, he never liked doing long-form stuff.
Yeah, he did it because he felt obligated to keep going.
Yeah. I mean, if he had his way, most of his better-known series are pre-Dragon Ball, and they're all fairly short.
Mm-hmm.
So,
2 years.
Yep. And a couple that he did technically post Dragon Ball still hook into Dragon Ball in one way or another. But I mean, Toriyama is not the kind of person to compare to because his art style ended up becoming an industry, literally a sub industry. So there are artists who have their entire careers based around being able to imitate his style for derivative works.
Someone's got to do Dai no Daibouken.
How many series did the...
Not just that, there's at least five. I can think of at least five different Dragon Ball manga that have nothing to do with Toriyama.
How many series did the Inuyasha author do? She also did...
it's got to be like eight.
Damn.
She did Ranma, she did Meizou no Ikkoku.
She has a couple that are ongoing right now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
She's still active.
Yeah, Rumiko Takahashi never stopped. Like, off the top of my head, Meizou no Ikkoku, Urusei Yatsura, Ranma 1/2, Inuyasha, Rinne. I don't know what her current series is, actually, now that I think about it.
Let's see. Did she do Mermaid Forest?
I think she did something. Yeah, she did Mermaid. I think it was called Mermaid Saga in English.
Yeah.
I have to check that out. I've been reading Inuyasha and it's really good. I tried to go back to the anime, but I find the old dub kind of hard to watch.
The other thing is that...
Yeah, I mean, Inuyasha was one of those that kind of suffered from the editors trying to keep it going as long as possible towards the end.
But, yeah, like, Inuyasha has, like, a story with momentum for the first, like, 30, 40 episodes, and then it just, like, loops.
But she has been active for, like, she's been active longer than I've been alive.
That's crazy.
Yeah, getting deep into the...
She's got a 50-year history here. Currently,
her current, like, one is Mao.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to remember.
Yeah, that was what I was trying to remember too, because I knew I'd seen it.
Oh, I'm gonna have to check it out.
And Rumic Theater is still ongoing for the past 40 years.
Oh, Fireminer even said no one can beat Takashi Rumiko when it comes to just creating hit after hit.
I mean, she's another one who's sort of become a sub industry.
Yeah, so. Yeah, except that they don't need a substitute yet. But
yeah. I mean, if you look at when she started, she began at towards the end of the Osamu Tezuka era.
Mm-hmm.
So she's very much a mangaka in that style.
Mm-hmm.
You see a lot of series that lasted maybe a total of a decade. Yeah, almost all of hers last either 10 or 20 years, mostly shorter. And yeah, so it seems like she's the type that manages a very well planned set and manages to sell the editors on doing just that set and then moving on.
Yeah.
I mean, for One Piece, you can argue that Oda does that, but every time he comes up with a new set, he just puts all the same characters into it and it just becomes the next plot arc.
Until now.
My daughters have been just watching the anime, and currently they've have two or three different arcs of the anime running concurrently on TV here. And so, like, the Wano Kuni arc and finished a bit, had the Fishman Island arc and Egghead arc going at the same time. And then Wano Kuni arc and another one right now. And these are not being shown in chronological order. But it's very much, it feels like each one, the Giant Kingdom is currently running too. It feels like each one is its own self-contained, at the same time, full story.
Mm-hmm.
In its own weird way. Even though it connects to everything else. So.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's part of how Oda is keeping sane with this, is that he's not... I mean, there is a single narrative going on, but it's also subdivided in such a way that if he really needs to cut and run, he can cut and run pretty easily.
Mm. So I'm gonna briefly, before we move on, I'm going to briefly bring up one other of the people I think of when I think of people who just made, like, a bazillion hits even if, like, this one is also someone who, like, he's largely inactive, although I think he still does stuff. I'm always shocked when I see that Gonagai is still alive. a man who should be turning 81 this year.
Jeez.
And any one of Cutie Honey, Devilman, or Mazinger would have had an extreme outsized influence on the future of manga. The fact that one person made all of them is terrifying.
He's turning 81 this year.
Yep. He was born in September of 1945.
Yep.
Yeah, just the kind of person that's done like a million and one things and reached eventually a point where he could just sort of do whatever. Again, kind of an industry unto himself. Like, there's all sorts of weird, constant reinterpretations of his old work.
I was gonna say, he kind of falls into the same generation as Rumiko Takahashi does. Just the folks who picked up towards the end of Osamu Tezuka's existence. And it's, yeah, I mean, that was more of the paradigm back during the 70s, was lots and lots of individual series and selling yourself as the style more than the plot.
Yeah, there was kind of a period where, like, a lot of the famous ones had, like, a bunch of series that ran for a few years.
Yeah, I mean, that was the paradigm up through the 90s even. But...
Mm-hmm.
Just okay. If they're active, so Go Nagai started in the late 60s. Takashi started in the late 70s, and in that decade, there was a ton of innovation. A lot of it from Osamu Tezuka, because the man never stopped. He had like 500 series by the end, I think.
Yeah, Tezuka did like a million things.
Tezuka was infamous for just accepting any job that anyone proposed to him and thinking about how he was going to do it later.
Mm-hmm. I bring him up a lot, but I'm a big fan of the work of Ikki Kajiwara, another guy who did like a million things, half of them deeply influential, especially sports drama. Like even if you're a live action wrestling fan, you owe something to both Ikki Kajiwara and Go Nagai.
Mm-hmm.
Because they provided gimmicks for two of the most celebrated Japanese wrestlers in history. to clarify, Go Nagai created the anime Jushin Liger, which... was then, like, there was someone who had Jushin Liger as their gimmick and was one of the most celebrated Japanese wrestlers of all time. And then Ikki Kajiwara was the co-creator of Tiger Mask, which there have been so many Tiger Masks, and so many of them are so important to Japanese wrestling, it's very funny. But, yeah. Okay, some brief ones. Okay, someone who worked on the Idolmaster games on the Xbox 360 recently tweeted that the number of Xbox 360 units in Japan at the time was only 50,000, so just hoping to be able to sell 30,000 copies to recoup their costs. They couldn't imagine that the game had the second best DLC sales in the world at the time. It makes me wonder if that period was when companies like Bandai and Koei learned they could just load their games up with DLC and get the diehards to empty their wallets. They were experimenting with that the second they got the chance. Like, there are tons of weird science experiments with what they can get away with, and eventually they just found what worked. And it turns out that, like, parasociality with a game character is the most easy way to get someone to empty their wallet. And horrors have been unleashed upon mankind ever since.
And let us never forget the horse armor.
Horse armor is quaint. It is a $5 purchase for something you don't need, but it's not pretending it's anything else.
Okay.
I look back and see how, like, horse armor is still a byword for, like, evil DLC, and it's like, this was someone telling you exactly what they were selling you, and like just charging more than ultimately made sense. But realistically, they told you exactly what you were buying. It was up to you whether that was worth $5. Mm-hmm. Like, we've gotten so, like, horse armor does not rank. It is merely like, if I walked up to you and said, I'll give you this potato for $5, you would rightly say, that's stupid, no. But that is essentially the equivalent of that. Like, if someone said yes, you wouldn't tell and say, like, look at what you did to him. It's like, he's the one who said he wanted to buy a potato for $5. I didn't lie to him about what the potato was. I didn't say it was a magic potato.
Potato.
Taters? What's taters?
Yeah, oh, God. Sorry. No, you're not doing the whole scene.
I am not.
Yeah. Okay. The longer a comic series or a wrestling feud runs, the more chance that the viewers are going to realize that the author isn't talented at all. That they only have a few good ideas and or a good editor. Has there been any game series which runs that long or as to have that problem? What I would say is not per se a game series, but what we see happen over and over is like a game is really good and one person is like the known person who was attached to it and is thus in the public's mind credited with its success. And then they go off to do their own thing and it turns out that they don't have the secret magical way to make a sauce. Game good. Yeah, like sauce is the word I was trying to avoid, but ultimately there was no reason to try because obviously that is the word. They don't have the secret sauce. Like, you know, the easy one, the easy punching bag to point out would be, say, Keiji Inafune. Like, you know, there was a certainty that, like, what had gone wrong with Mega Man was something to do with Capcom, and now that Inafune was striking out on his own and was with his new company, that this new bicycle helmet Mega Man would be incredible. And no, we all saw Mighty No. 9. Even if you liked it, it was not a particularly incredible experience.
No, I liked it. If it had been like an indie game with no like renown, it would have been like, this is cool. Attached. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like that's one that I would think of where like it's more that like the Halo effect hits specific designers that have their name out. Like, I think that there's a long history of that happening to anyone who was treated as a rock star designer. The dear departed Tomino Itagaki post leaving Tecmo produces The Devil's Third, an extremely troubled project. It's not good. Like, you can look at, like, a bunch of the, say, like, we could go all the way back to, like, someone who I still think is quite talented, John Romero, but, like, you go back to the late 90s, post-Doom, pre-Daikatana, post-Doom Quake, pre-Daikatana, John Romero is, like, treated as the guy. And then, you know, Daikatana comes out and it's like, oh, it turns out that a bad development cycle can happen to anyone. Mm. Yuji Naka, another person that like, oh, this is a guy with the secret sauce for Sonic. And then, you know, a Balan Wonderworld happened. yeah, you can, this list is a mile long. And some of these are still very talented people in specific domains or in certain like, managerial contexts, like, you know, John Romero has made interesting good things since. Yuji Naka even has made good things at various points in his life, but he is his primary discipline is programmer. His games tend to be technically impressive, but you know, you look at these over and over and like, this just happens. It is the nature of going full auteur without contemplating like how like systems and teams are set up to create a path to success and how people, even if someone is like a key creative visionary, how those circumstances are necessary to make sure that vision occurs. But yeah.
You can say the same thing with authors at times too. So mm-hmm.
That's where the question came from.
Yeah. Oh, sorry. I'm blanked on that part.
Yeah. Like, I can't think of anything where it's like this person just has straight up bad ideas, although almost all of the things that we've mentioned have bad ideas in them. Like, Balin's insistence on simple controls, which is a continuing element of Naka's design philosophy. He always wants those, like, one-button control schemes. That's the kind of games he wants to make, and, like, as it turns out, there are limitations to what that can do, and you need other designers to apparently keep him in line to not try to do that where it doesn't make sense. I'm trying to think of, like, the tie that binds some of these things together. I'm trying to remember half the people I just rattled off. The concept of, like, the dash kill in Mighty Number 9 contributes to more than a few of that game's problems, and it was over and over pointed out to people playing betas, this is irritating and I don't like it. And the design did not change from first demo to final release. I would say that kind of counts. Okay, to hit a few more. Tekken and Soul Calibur has the problem of Bandai executive interference and undervaluing. Activision drives their studios to make franchise games annually to the point no creator has the space to come up with new ideas. Mega Man X was outsourced a lot, and Capcom at the time had difficulty in pinpointing an identity for the series. The only case I can think of are Deadly Premonition, the streamer-friendly horror games like Poppy's Playtime. Those games also tend to be extraordinarily reactive, is what I would say. Where, like, especially when you look at something like streamer-focused horror, you end up with things that are, like, the tail wags the dog. They start building games for streaming, like, to get the audience, like, not even just a game built for streaming. You can do plenty with a game built for an audience. But when the game design is designed for more and more specific streamers...
Hmm. I remember, I can't remember exactly which mascot horror game this was, but one of the criticisms I saw leveled at it was that it was basically designed to tempt the game theory guys into making a video about it.
I think I know exactly which one you're thinking of, because there's an infamous screenshot that floats around. I think you're thinking of Hello Neighbor, because...
That might have been it.
Because there's an infamous screenshot that floats around all the time, because it's one of the saddest things I've ever seen a marketing team do. Because it's the official Twitter for Hello Neighbor, like, every time a trailer or demo goes up, it's like, @MattPatGT will have plenty of things to say about this one, and, like, they never bothered making a video about that. They didn't care. Yeah. But it was just, like, one of the saddest things that you could possibly be doing as a marketing team. But yeah, ultimately, yeah, that kind of thing where like your design ends up perving to facilitate the streamer market can like, especially very specific streamers can produce like truly ugly results artistically. Okay, Masami Kudamada is another Oda-like case. He recently announced that he was ready to make the final arc of Saint Seiya. The man is 72. And given how long it took for him to finish the previous arc, Saint Seiya fans all hope that he will leave detailed notes so that someone can take over in the worst case. I always forget Saint Seiya is not actually finished.
I hadn't realized it.
What is Saint Seiya?
Yeah, Saint Seiya is an incredibly... influential like manga.
You probably recognize this one.
Yeah, it's like a lot of times, like in various places, it'll be marketed as like Knights of the Zodiac.
Because that was the French title of it.
Yeah, but it's popular in all parts. America.
Like the original the original serialization run was from 1985 to 1990.
Yeah, so, and he just sort of keeps coming back.
The first series is done, but there have been expansions.
Yeah,
every few years he'll sort of come back to it.
Yeah. So there was a second series, actually, I mean, every few years, but realistically, it only restarted back in 2022.
Mm-hmm.
Or the next manga series. And yeah. So the, and everything else in there has been just side material, basically. There's a sequel, some side material. So most of it has been just expansion, but in the last 4 years, he's actually attempted a complete new series.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, Saint Seiya is also just one of those manga that like caught on basically everywhere but the Anglosphere. Like it's huge in all sorts of other languages, just not in English.
I have a couple friends. I had a couple friends in Italy who just really loved the series.
Yeah, France, Italy, Latin America, especially.
Selling it short, but it's. Do you remember Ronin Warriors?
Oh God, I do remember Ronin Warriors.
It was from the same period and the same style of or same subgenre. I'm really trying to avoid a Sailor Moon reference, but there are some similarities in plot as well.
To give Saint Seiya a little more context about what Fire Miner's getting at, it looks like Saint Seiya Next Dimension ran from 06 to 2024. So
yeah.
And that seems to have been essentially a direct sequel. So
that's the main sequel, but it's not all by the same guy.
Next Dimension itself seems to have been Kurumada, though.
Yeah, Kurumada.
Yeah, Kurumada, sorry. Remember, he's like associated with at least one other thing I've heard of. Ring ni Kakero. That's the other thing I've heard of. That's him. That's another boxing manga.
They were really popular for a while.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, like, speaking of things that will never end, especially not in a way the audience would find satisfying, Hajime no Ippo.
Oh, that was tragic.
For those not aware, Hajime no Ippo started in 1989. It's currently on 145 volumes.
Jeez.
It's theoretically supposed to be about a kid named Ippo, like, you know, working his way to becoming a world-class boxer. Like, 6 years ago, I want to say, like, it was revealed that, like, he was going to at least temporarily have to retire because he was now suffering what appeared to be the onset of CTE.
Oh, lovely.
That's been a major plot point. Yes.
This happened before he had any sort of blow-off fight with any of his rivals. Which is a wild choice, and I respect it, but also I would be so pissed off. But yeah, Ippo is one of those things that, like, I have to suspect that its creator, who apparently goes, Joji Murakawa, is like, God, he has to be he is on the younger side of what I would have guessed, being a spry man of 60. Like Ippo must have been a very early success, relatively speaking. Because let's see, Ippo started in 1989, so he was 23 when it started. But yeah, like that's one of those ones that's like, oh my God, whatever happens there is going to piss everyone off.
It sounds like basically Rocky getting CTE and never fighting the Russian guy, essentially.
Yeah. Ivan Drago?
Yes.
Maybe that should have happened, because then we could have missed out on Tommy Gunn.
Well, it did eventually lead to the Creed movies.
It eventually led to the Creed movies, and Rocky Balboa is at least an acceptable film. Let us all contemplate Mason the Lion Dixon. Just making wheels suffer. No, if I were to recommend, I will briefly sidebar to once again recommend that if someone wants to read a boxing manga of digestible length in English, Ashinojo is currently about 2/3 done with its nice hardbound translations, and it's a absolutely amazing comic. That's coming in like 8 premium volumes in English, I believe. Originally it was about 20 volumes in Tankobon format. But wonderful, wonderful series. Let's see. Okay. And to tag on to one of the things you had mentioned, speaking of Ronin Warriors and the original Japanese version of it, Samurai Troopers, got a sequel just earlier this year. The new series is another example of the writers having a few interesting ideas at the start, but lacking the skill and patience to build upon them. So things just kind of petered out at the end. On the one hand, that's sad. On the other hand, that's exactly what I would have expected from a revival of Ronin Warriors. Let's see. Talked a lot about lately about how the traditional structure of an SMT story and how restrictive it can be, but like all, are all those structures and conventions and cliches are there because the writers are truly passionate about them, or do they think that they've found the most optimized framework for the type of SMT game SMT is? Just how flexible are SMT mechanics, and how much are they both rely and dictate the story? So I think the mechanics are actually pretty story independent, which is why we always see them worm their way into other kinds of games, like. Especially back in the day, you know, like you could do, you know, like the modern Persona is taking SMT mechanics and applying them to a different kind of RPG. Raidoku Zenoha is taking them and applying them to an action RPG. Even Digital Devil Stalk is taking the like combat mechanics, but applying a different kind of, a different kind of progression mechanic. I think that the mechanics themselves are actually quite versatile, and people just sort of like them, you know? Like, they turn an average combat encounter into kind of a puzzle of what is the least resources I can invest in this while getting through it cleanly. And I think that ultimately what restricts SMT story-wise is a belief that, like, a mainline SMT has a very specific structure and concept. I remember that Shin Megami Tensei: Strange Journey looks for all the world like pretty close to just being a normal SMT game, but allegedly internally it was never considered SMT4 from the moment that they decided that it was set in Antarctica, because an SMT game takes place in Tokyo. Like, and that is where I think that the weight of expectation puts very specific ideas on what Shin Megami Tensei as a mainline series is and can be. I think that the spin-offs existed as a pressure release valve to allow them to do more creative things with that. Which is not to say that there aren't interesting creative things that can be done, like Tokyo's a rich setting, like lots of interesting things you can do with mythology and pop psychology. Those are the things I would consider the core ingredients of a mainline SMT. Like, Tokyo, pop psychology, pop philosophy, and mythology. Like,
and those Carl Jung.
Sometimes Jung will be there because pop philosophy, but sometimes he won't.
Yes.
But yeah, like, that's, you know, that, but, you know, the feeling internally, even 15 years ago, being, well, Shin Megami Tensei takes place in Tokyo, shows that there is like some degree of internal restriction on what Shin Megami Tensei can be. And so creativity from it has to come from finding unique angles to strike these, to form that line with all of those components. So you saw like Shin Megami Tensei 4 took place in Tokyo, but starred people who were like apart from it and treated Tokyo as observers, and how Tokyo affected them. Or Shin Megami Tensei 3, you're starting as someone who is a normal person from Tokyo, but who has been set apart from humans, and thus sees Tokyo from a different perspective. And this new Tokyo from a different perspective than a normal person, where you observe them and they're all like dying or like falling into extreme ideologies. Like, you have to approach it from something that will reach all of these core ideas, but without actually, like, replace, and like, without replacing one of these core pillars. Those pillars always have to be there. And, you know, a lot of great creativity comes from restriction. When I say that I think that the underlying, like, requirements of an SMT game are pretty restrictive, I'm not saying that means that they are bad or need to change. I think that deciding, well, we'll have more freedom if we don't adhere to this, often is a, like, a fool's gold idea. Like, it's something that sounds really good on paper, it looks like a great idea, and then you do it and it's like, well, we've lost our identity and we've opened up a lot of creative avenues, but there's now nothing binding together what we should be aiming for. So I do get why they go for this, but I do think that the mechanics, the underlying mechanics, are actually quite malleable, and that's why the series has been so prone to spin-offs.
I need to leave in a few minutes, so.
Yeah, how about you do your plug for now?
Okay. Anyway, so yes, I have a new book out.
Hey!
Called The Sin of Tantalus by Michael Spearwater, S-P-E-A-R-W-A-T-E-R. It's... how do I describe it here? Cozy cannibal dystopia, you know? Most people are doing fine, except for the people who are about to be eaten. All fun games and all that. So The Sin of Tantalus, just me trying out different things, trying to use tropes from zombie stories without actually using zombies, because I really don't like zombies. So check that out. It's, it went live last weekend, and people enjoy it. Other than that, everything else that I always talk about, Princesses of the Pizza Parlor, Tanuki is a Teapot, Vainglorious Long is the Night, all by Michael Yarimizu, Yarimizu, because, hey, yay, pen names. And also, under the other names, Michael Spearwater, we have A Wager for Wanderlust, which is Fantasy World, Travelogue, spicier than most of the stuff I write, so that's why I started using a second pen name. So lots of stuff out there. Have fun, read. Lots to read. Enjoy. That's all I can say. Okay, anyway, I need to get going because I've got a class starting in about 30 minutes. So.
Gambate.
Yes, thank you. Okay.
Goodbye.
And I should have a lot more time next week.
Excellent.
Next Tuesday. Okay, good. So see you then. Bye-bye.
Bye.
We should probably get to. I probably need to get to bed soon. So.
You know what?
God, just fucking left. Damn it! Why?
I don't know. I want fun sounds, and they don't.
I will put you into the ground.
Someone find me a better soundboard than Discord's built-in garbage.
No. You're on your own there, buddy. I will show you when you visit Seattle. Okay. Joe, where can we find you and what will we see when we get there?
Okay, so I'm still streaming for RP Gamer every Tuesday and Thursday night starting around 10 p.m. Unless I, lose track of time. I do start late sometimes. Anywho, so I'm playing Xenoblade Chronicles X for Switch 2, and I'm not that far into it, so you're not going to miss much, but you're also not going to get any late game spoilers as of yet, so do consider checking that out on twitch.tv/rpgamer, the channel you might be watching right now. And also, you can check out my YouTube channel under Smokin' Joe Gamer. I have a bunch of videos on there. I keep saying that I'm going to do Metroidvania content, so hopefully I'll feel compelled to do more episodes of that little series that I do every year. And you can also follow me on Blue Sky and Instagram under Smokin' Joe Gamer. And I just post random crap about video games, TV shows, movies, books, music, whatever. So you can check all that stuff out if you'd like. Like and follow, subscribe, etc. That helps me out, makes me feel good. I need my dopamine. All right. But right now I'm just doing some quests in Final Fantasy XIV before my subscription expires and I let it lapse for who knows how long. Yeah.
Eat shit and die. what else was I going to say? And you can ask us questions like dear friend Fireminer has. Thank you for showing up, Fireminer. Let's see. You can ask us questions if you catch us when we're streaming, which is usually somewhere between 8 and 9 p.m. Pacific, 11 to midnight Eastern, until whenever one of us is too tired or dead to go on. You can also ask us questions if you catch us at twitch.tv/RPGamer during those times. Those would be on Monday nights in the U.S. You can also ask us questions by going to the comments section of RP Gamer. Thanks once again to Fireminer for double checking to make sure that we didn't miss any.
Thank you, Fireminer.
What else was I gonna say?
Gonna throw in, I may do some random Indiana Jones streams. That game will be out tomorrow.
Yeah, it's fucked up. That completely snuck up on me.
Looking forward to punching Nazis.
Yeah. Aren't we all? What about whipping them, though?
It's even better.
You can shoot them, too.
Even better.
But, yeah. You can also check our sister show, Shenanigans, where we just sort of do whatever yesterday we were playing. Leon Must Die Forever, as the new Resident Evil 9 DLC. Next week, who knows? Maybe we'll get a be in our bonnet to play a fighting game. Who can say? But otherwise, I think that about wraps it up for us. So see you, Space Cowboys.
See you.
Good night.
This is Mole Man in the morning. Good Mole Man to you.
What fun.
What fun.
I'm in hell.